Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Ask anyone who's had a major water leak and they'll tell you most of the damage could have been prevented if they had been able to stop the leak sooner. Groa, maker of innovative German-engineered showers and faucets, is helping busy homeowners like you prevent water damage and protect your home even when you're away. The new Groa SenseGuard is an intuitive, smart water controller that detects leaks, alerts you via your smartphone, and automatically shuts off your water supply before more damage is done. Protect your home, vacation, or rental properties with Groa SenseGuard and quickly stop water damage before a drip becomes a flood. Listeners of Inside the Hive can save 35% on Groa SenseGuard only at groa.us/hive19. That's groahe.us/hive and the number 19. Once again, save 35% on Groa SenseGuard at groa.us/hive19. Welcome to Inside the Hive. I am your host, Nick Bilton, and I am also the guest this week, and I'm going to be interviewed by the none other than John Kelly. John?
Yeah, Nick, we're gonna change things around this week. I'm sick of hearing your voice. No, that's not true. We are doing what Bill Simmons calls an emergency pod because you've just published on the Hive a real shit-kicking piece of reporting about the final days of Theranos. We are living in another Theranos moment. It seems that wherever you look, people continue to be fascinated by the demise of Elizabeth Holmes' unicorn blood testing company. There's the HBO documentary that's coming out. There's the ABC News podcast. Adam McKay is casting Jennifer Lawrence to play Elizabeth Holmes in a future movie based on John Carreyrou's book, which has sold 500,000 copies. But you have the exclusive story on what happened in the final days, weeks, and months leading to its demise. So let's get right into it, okay?
Let's do it. Let's party.
So, Nick, I think the most exciting and terrifying and just weird part of your story, it begins in September 2017. So, and just to paint the room, as you like to say, by September 2017, Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos are in pretty dire shape, right?
The SEC, they're in big trouble.
Big trouble. Carreyrou's already been investigating the company for 2 years. You'd written a big story about Theranos. The FBI, the SEC, they're all investigating the company. Walgreens, which was basically its only revenue source, has shuttered the relationship. Everyone knows that its blood testing kit, the Edison, doesn't work reliably, and that Elizabeth Holmes's quixotic plan to take a pinprick of blood and test for like a jillion diseases isn't going to work. Most people would have given up. They would have settled. They would have worked with lawyers to deal with regulators to try and make this all go away. But Elizabeth Holmes had a different plan. Why don't you tell us what she was going to do?
So Elizabeth Holmes, in her typical Elizabeth Holmesian fashion, decides that she is going to deal with this situation in a very different way. So in the early days with Theranos, she actually took private jets all over the place. She used to fly in a Gulfstream jet, and that's according to Carreyrou's reporting in his book. And also, she also told the New Yorker that a few years ago. But she now downgraded to only flying first class. So she still has two drivers. She has two personal assistants. She has her own security detail. She's driven around. Sometimes she's driven around in an armored car. She's being driven around now in a big black Cadillac Escalade. And she has this team drive her to the airport, and she gets on a first class flight, and she goes all the way to the East Coast. And there she goes to a dog breeder's house, and she gets a 9-week-old Siberian Husky. So she has the name picked out for the Husky. It's called Balto. So Balto, it's not the cartoon from Disney. The crazy part about the Balto story is Balto is this famous dog, also a Siberian Husky, who in the early 1900s, I think it was over 1925 or so, ends up doing this famous run in Alaska. It's about a 600-mile run from Anchorage to the small little town where people are dying from diphtheria. And Balto, this dog, as folklore goes, ends up getting them this this medicine that saves everyone and stops the world from crumbling to this disease.
So there's a metaphorical quality here, right?
This is this total metaphorical quality here. So she decides she's going to call her Siberian husky Balto, and so she comes back to Palo Alto. And she decides also that Balto is going to go with her everywhere she goes. She's going to follow her through the labs, with the blood testing going on, in board meetings, you name it. But there's a few problems. Of course, the scientists are like, what the fuck are you doing? This is a blood testing facility. You're getting dog hair all over the blood samples. And she's like, whatever, it's fine, not a big deal. And then Balto, of course, is not potty trained, and because he's partially so young. And so he is in the middle of board meetings with Elizabeth, and, you know, there's people like Henry Kissinger in the room, and Balto's like taking a dump in the corner of the room, and the personal assistants and security detail are left to kind of clean up the mess.
What do you think was the impetus behind her acquisition of Balto? Was it that she was trying to, did she just want company on some human level? Was
no.
she trying to tell employees that this is a metaphor for how we're going to regrow the company? Or did she just want to look nuts?
I think it's a little bit of everything with the exception of the company. I've seen pictures of her with Balto, and by the way, the Balto story gets crazier, and we'll get to where and how it gets crazier in a minute. But you know, she seems to like the dog. She would put it on her lap and pet it, and it went with her everywhere from home. She was still living at the time in the Los Altos Hills in a 10,000 square foot house by herself. Most of the rooms were empty, as I report in the story. She has some furniture which her mom had shipped out in a shipping container because Elizabeth didn't buy any furniture, partially because I don't think her brain worked that way. But Balto's in the office with her, meetings on planes, you name it, and I think that she thought that it was a good story. What Elizabeth is incredible at is telling stories, and I think that the idea that she could have this dog with her, that she gets to tell this story about this dog that saved humanity, essentially, in her eyes, just like she was doing with Theranos. It was kind of an uplifting story of how she was going to do the same thing for her company, Theranos. What happens, though, is that somewhere along the way, pretty soon, actually, after she gets the dog, she somehow figures out that Balto, like all dogs, by the way, is like 2% wolf. And from this moment forward, she decides that she's now, whenever anyone asks what kind of dog Balto is, or if they say, is that a Siberian husky, Elizabeth responds by saying, no, it's a wolf. So she's literally walking around all over Palo Alto, all over the office, telling people that her dog is actually a wolf.
I'm surprised, actually, at some point that the police weren't called, because I'm serious, though. You would think in a in an extremely wealthy Northern California bedroom community like Palo Alto or Los Altos, that if some mom asked, oh, what's your breed of dog? And Elizabeth Holmes said, it's a wolf. She'd say, holy shit, I'm going to call pest control or whatever you do now. But wait, so Nick, I want to stay on Balto, but in the Balto era here, because it's a really dark time, right? There's all this money being spent on legal fees, but tell us what Elizabeth Holmes' lifestyle is like, because I know that there had to be some downsizing to account for all the lawsuits, but was she weaning off of the luxury she'd gotten used to?
She had weaned off a little bit of the luxury she'd gotten used to. I mean, I think, you know, and you know, some of this is detailed in this story. Some of it's detailed in John Carreyrou's book, Bad Blood, which you should read. Truly incredible. And some of it you can just see photos of. But what happens is, one of the things that Elizabeth was really good at was spending money and other people's money. And so they end up getting $900 million, almost $1 billion in funding, which literally she just flittered away. At first, she's spending money on stupid things, you know, like a $100,000 conference room table that I have no idea how you pull off $100,000 on a single conference room table. Other things she's spending money on is she is flying on private jets. She's got her own security detail. As I said earlier, she's got this home in the Los Altos Hills that Theranos is paying for, which costs tens of thousands of dollars a month. She is expensing everything. One person told me that I spoke to that she would literally sometimes expense the six mile drive, the gasoline for the 6 mile drive from her house to the office.
There's also a great line in that story that in your story where someone tells you someone had to be paying for all those Birkin bags.
Yeah, and she's living a very lavish lifestyle, flying all over the world. She also, this is not in the piece, but this is something that I heard numerous times, is that she loves to talk about her celebrity friends. She would, some come into the office and be like, oh, I was at Sheryl's house last night, or I'm seeing Mark for lunch later. Not saying, of course, Mark Zuckerberg, but, implying that based on the fact that, who sure. Mark is in Silicon Valley. And so she's living this very lavish lifestyle. And I think that at some point, someone says to her, hey, this is not necessarily your money to be spending, on all these crazy things. And she's dismissive of it. I think a few people actually told her this. And eventually she agrees to, downgrade to first class, and she kind of tones it down a little bit. But at the very, very end of the company, when there's literally just over a dozen people left, the last few employees were two of her personal assistants, her two drivers, she had to have two drivers, and her security detail, and a publicist that she had the company paying $25,000 a month for. Oh, so, the company is completely crumbling, and it's still half of the employees are dedicated to Elizabeth Holmes.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
Life insurance is one of those topics that everyone knows a little about, but do you understand it well enough to actually feel comfortable buying it? Whether you're an insurance expert or a newbie, Policy Genius created a website that makes it easy for you to compare quotes, get advice, and get covered. Policy Genius is the easy way to get life insurance. In minutes, you can compare quotes from top insurers to find the coverage that you need at a price you can afford. From there, you just apply online, and the advisors of Policy Genius will help handle all the red tape. And trust me, there's a lot of red tape in insurance. They'll even negotiate your rate with the insurance company. There's no extra fees, no commission sales agents, just helpful advice and personalized service. And it's not just there for life insurance. I recently used it to get an auto insurance quote. It's brilliant, easy, so simple to use. You have to check it out. So no matter how much or how little you know about life insurance, you can find the right policy in minutes at policygenius.com. Once again, that is policygenius.com. Policy Genius, the easy way to compare and buy life insurance.
In the 1980s and 90s, New York City needed a tough cop like Detective Louis Scarcella.
Putting bad guys away, there's no feeling like it in the world.
He was the guy who made sure the worst killers were brought to justice.
That's one version.
This guy is a piece of shit.
Derek Hamilton was put away for murder by Detective Scarcella.
In prison, Derek turned himself into the best jailhouse lawyer of his generation.
And the law was my girlfriend. This is my only way to freedom.
Derek and other convicted murderers
started a law firm behind bars.
We never knew we had the same cop in the case.
Scarcella.
We gotta show that he's a corrupt cop.
They can go f*** themselves.
I'm Steve Fishman.
And I'm Dax Devlin Ross. And this is The Burden. Listen to new episodes of The Burden starting March 19th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And to hear episodes 1 week early and ad-free with exclusive content, subscribe to True Crime Clubhouse on Apple Podcasts.
One of the other real sort of totems of the decline of Theranos is that you document in the story. Is they moved from 1701 is what they called it, right? 1701 Page Mill Road, which is the really extravagant office space they were in that I think cost around $1 million a month to rent. I mean, just really extravagant. It wasn't their lab. It wasn't the technical office. It was the sort of show-off office. And then they moved to Newark, right? What did that transition signify? Because that seemed to be some sort of demonstration of defeat on some level, right?
So the thing that I think is the most astounding, and this comes from numerous former employees and executives I spoke to for this story, even a former board member. The thing that's so astounding is that, you know, it's amazing that the company raised almost $1 billion and spent most of it. What's more amazing is that in the last year of the company's life, there was $250 million in the bank, and all of it was spent within 1 year. And by some estimates, 90% of that was on legal fees. There was a point in time where I was told by a couple of people that there was as many as 9 different law firms on retainer representing Theranos, Elizabeth Holmes, Sonny Balwani, her former boyfriend and also co-conspirator who ran the company with her. They all had indemnity agreements with Theranos so that if anything ever happened, the company would have to pay for their legal fees. So they're literally going through millions and millions and millions of dollars a month just paying legal fees. They're being investigated by everyone. They have civil suits, you name it, coming after them. And at the same time, they have this $1 million a month rent for this building, 1701 Page Mill. They have, you know, millions plus for employees and of course, Elizabeth's lifestyle. And so they eventually have to pack up shop. I asked one source, you know, who was there that day, was Elizabeth upset? Like, did she leave, you know, and stop? And as you would if your company was crumbling.
Sure, sure, it's human.
Your own volition. Did she stop and her and Balto have a moment where they looked back at the room and the person said no, she just walked out the door. Like it was, and this is something that I heard from everyone I spoke to throughout this entire thing. She's happy and chirpy and chipper and just not oblivious because she knows what's going on, but just seems like she doesn't give a shit what's going on. She thinks that it's all going to work out. And it doesn't matter. And she's walking around the office as happy as can be. And so what happens is they have no choice but to leave the main Theranos headquarters. And they go across the bay to Newark, California, not Newark, New Jersey, although it would have been more apt.
Sure. It's an appropriate comparison here. Yeah.
Yeah. Appropriate comparison. And they go there. And the Newark lab is essentially the last place standing. And the Arizona lab that they had been shut down. The Theranos headquarters had been actually, ironically, have been now taken over by Stanford University, which is where Elizabeth originally went to school and where this whole thing started. And they moved to the Newark lab. And the Newark lab is a, if you imagine, a massive, massive building that used to be home to a solar panel maker. Mm-hmm. And so they put some of the lab stuff down there, and then all the employees go up to the second floor. And immediately, you know, people have described the Newark lab to me as essentially kind of a little grimy. Someone said it was a shithole. Someone actually said that they were happy they were there because it was like this was the opportunity to stop focusing on the glitz and the glamour that was of the old building with the fancy cafeteria and all the fancy furniture and whatnot. And it was like this was the opportunity to get down to business. And so they get there and everyone is sharing these desks. It's like four people to a desk. They all lost their offices and cubicles and whatnot, except Elizabeth, who takes a big corner office with Balto the Wolf. Dun, dun, dun.
You know, one of the things that people forget about Theranos is, you know, look, most companies fail, right? And I think that for a long time, some parts of there were some communities within Silicon Valley that that almost forgave her because they didn't, they knew you fake it till you make it, in some degree. And that's not something that I think is an acceptable excuse when it comes to a biomedical company or a company that purported to do what she said Theranos was going to do. But one thing that is shocking to me that you get at in this story is her accountability to the board. Like, as you said before, she was an extraordinary bullshitter. She raised $900 and some million from, you know, from people as smart as Rupert Murdoch. She was able to tell a great story to the tech press that ate it up. But it's hard to bullshit Dr. K. I know that the board was not made up of scientists, but still, like Jim Mattis, Henry Kissinger, these were really smart people on the board. I think Bill Frist is on the board too. What was your sense of her relationship with the board in the later stage of the company's life?
It's a great question, and it's one that I had grappled with trying to understand that up until doing this story. And I've written a bunch of stories on Theranos, as of a lot of people. And the thing I could never figure out, well, the two things I could never figure out, one was, you know, what kind of psychological problems Elizabeth Holmes must have that she doesn't feel regret about this whole thing. But that's an unanswerable question. But the question that is answerable is what was going on with the board. And this is the case, this is the thing that bothers me most about Silicon Valley in general. You know, you have Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg doing things that are affecting our democracy. You have Jack Dorsey doing things that are also hurting our democracy with bots and not stopping the hate speech and so on. It's just Elon Musk just this week, you know, tweeting things that he's not supposed to tweet that could upset the SEC. And you have, I think, a situation with Elizabeth Holmes where the board does nothing here also. So I did ask one of the board members, a former board member, you know, what's going on when this is all taking place? Is the board upset? Are they, you know, are they trying to like get her to stop doing what she's doing? Are they talking about putting someone new in? What is going on? And the thing that I was told was in the early days, the board actually did, they did like Elizabeth. They thought she was amazing. They were smitten with her. When the original Carrieu thing happens.
Nick, just to pin you down quickly there before we go to what happened after John's articles came out. Is it fair to say that these are not scientifically savvy people necessarily? They're people who've made their careers in you know, statecraft or the law. But that at the very least, they saw a young, charismatic person who was just trying to disrupt, like, you know, I mean, lab testing is like a $60 billion industry. But was there some sense that you know, the product would get there one day, even if it wasn't there now? And that
they believed that the product was there. Okay. You know, Elizabeth had told them that the product was there, that they were, that the company was making money, that the Arizona lab was making money. You know, they believe that this is a company that is on its way to being a multi-billion-dollar company, which it is, and it's going to, you know, be profitable in IPO and change the lab testing industry and make trillions of dollars and God knows what. The thing you keep bringing up, and a lot of people keep bringing this up, is, you know, Henry Kissinger, people like that, these are super smart people. I think for a lot of these guys on the board, and I say guys because it was all men, they'd spend their life in public service, and usually what happens when you do that is you go on and you write a book and you go do some speaking and you make a good amount of money and you have a nice life but you don't get rich. And I think that the opportunity to get on some of these boards is usually where at the end of these people's careers, when they're in their 90s, 70s, 80s, 90s, is that they actually get to make some money that they can leave for their family. And I think that they were smitten by Elizabeth and they saw this as an opportunity to make a lot of money. And I think that they didn't necessarily ask the right questions in the process there. The time that they do start asking questions is after Carrieu's story comes out, and it turns out that there are some government agencies that are investigating Holmes and Theranos because the test results aren't accurate. And one of the board members says, or a few of the board members say, hey, why don't we just put this to rest? You know, let's do a test, a blood test, and we will compare it to blood tests from two or three other companies and a university lab. And if all the tests are accurate and line up, then we can say, hey, screw you, we're great, you're wrong, and we can keep going. If it turns out the tests are not wrong, we have $250 million in the bank, we can fix the problem and get back to business. Say we made a mistake, no big deal. So Elizabeth said, hey, great idea, and off she goes to do the test. But every time the board kept saying, where are the results, she had a different story. She at one point said that there'd been a problem with the test. Another point, she said that the results weren't in yet. There was always this different thing. And finally, I said to someone, I said, you know, was there ever a point that the board lost it and said, what the hell's going on here? And there was one moment when, and this is, you know, around the time, shortly before Balto comes along, but this one moment where there was someone who was brought into the board to a financial person to explain some of the finances going on in the company because the board was asking, and they came to realize that they had been told that the Arizona lab was making a lot more money than it actually was, and they had been essentially deceived, and they at this point lost it. And one person apparently was irate. Shortly after that, of course, Elizabeth switched up the board and put new people in.
But Theranos had no real revenue, right? I mean, it was only in about 40 Walgreens, and that was the only source of revenue. Was she lying to board members? Was she telling them that there was money that just wasn't there?
I asked, and the response I got was not a yes, she was lying. It was that she was not being forthright with the truth, which was a very, you know, kind of careful way of saying it. But I think that she was. I think that when you look at the evidence, and if you look at the criminal complaints, and you look at the SEC, they all say the same thing, that she was dishonest. And it was grossly dishonest across the board in every instance. And I think that it's just astounding that she managed to do this for so long.
One of the most interesting things in your story, towards the end of the end of Theranos, so now we're into 2018, you know, people are being, I guess, you know, asked to give depositions to government agencies. They're resigning every day. They're going to that famous bar in Palo Alto to have goodbye parties. And she was in a fantastic mood. She was not. Most people would have seeped into a great depression, but Elizabeth Holmes either had compartmentalized it or turned it on. And you describe her in the story as being like unbelievably perky and friendly to colleagues and acting as though nothing had happened.
So the company is at this point. So I'll go back to when they get to the Newark lab. They, you know, all the employees are there. And the one thing that's interesting about Theranos is Elizabeth and Sonny Balwani, who had now been pushed out of the company at this point, for years had given speeches in front of the employees, often in the cafeteria, and you have people in lab coats and, you know, scientists and physicians, you name it, all standing around listening to these speeches, and engineers and PR people and everything, and lawyers. And they would always often end these speeches with a kind of chant. Like at one point there was a chant about a competitor where they led the chant with "fuck you" in the competitor's name. When John Carreyrou had first put out his story in 2015 about all the problems at Theranos, Balwani led a chant that Elizabeth was involved in and everyone else got involved with, that was "fuck you, Carreyrou," his last name. And everyone cheered. And it was just a part of the company's DNA. And so when they get to the Newark lab and they're very clearly kind of running on fumes as far as money goes at this point, Elizabeth manages to secure money. So she holds a big all hands meeting, gathers everyone around, and she says, "It's great news. Fortress, the hedge fund, is gonna give us $100 million loan secured against our patents and investments and this, that, and the other. And it's, you know, we have a new runway of $100 million to fix everything." And she stops the speech, and it's dead silent, like not a squeak, not a breath, nothing.
And you think it's because people, her colleagues, thought that she was stupid? They hated her.
They were so sick of the fact that, first of all, they just at this point knew that this was never going to get fixed. She, you know, they're watching this person who is, her back's up against the wall, like shit's falling apart everywhere, the seams, the boards leaving, the millions a month in legal fees, you name it. And what does she do? She goes and gets a dog that she brings to the office that she starts calling a wolf. Like there, she's walking around, everyone's, you know, completely depressed. They're being asked to give depositions to the FDA and the SEC and this, that, and the other. They're all terrified that you know, they've got lawyers. It's just pure craziness. And Elizabeth is wandering around like it's her birthday and hugging people and smiling and laughing and, you know, offering to find them jobs. And it's just crazy. And And I think they're just, at this point, they're just fed up. And so she gives the speech and they're like, no one says anything. And Elizabeth's shocked because in her mind, they should all be cheering. Like, we're all in this together. We're all on this quest from, you know, Anchorage, Alaska with Balto to save the universe. And everyone was just, they were done. And she said, does anyone have any questions? And again, it was just pure silence. And I think, you know, after that, you know, people really started to leave the company. As you mentioned, there's a famous bar in Palo Alto called Antonio's Nut House. And it's famous because it's where all the, it's a total shithole. I've been there before. There's a gorilla in the middle that serves you. It's not a real gorilla, but it serves you peanuts. You know, it's like the tip, it's the diviest dive bar you could imagine. And, you know, Mark Zuckerberg and Apple executives.
A dive bar in the richest square mile of God's green earth, yeah.
Yeah, and it's, I think the irony is like, you know, people like Zuckerberg, I've been there with some people from Apple and Google and places like that, like they go because it's like, they're just like us, you know? And so, but a lot of the times because it's this dive bar that's become an icon in the Valley, people have going away parties when employees leave to go to other companies. What happened with Theranos in the last year is you could have shown up there any night of the week and there would be a going away drinks thing for someone who worked at that company. People were leaving in such droves.
What was the vibe of the people that you've talked to who've left Theranos? Have they been blackballed by their experience there, or is there so much volatility in Silicon Valley that they just move on?
I'll say two things. One is, And I said this to the one of the sources I spoke to first and then went back to later after I spoke to several other people. But one of the things that is consistent is people hate Elizabeth that used to work for her. They have such anger towards her. They feel so slighted by her. They think that she screwed up their careers, their lives, that she lied, that she didn't care about anyone but herself, and people are really angry at her, and justifiably so. And the reason for that is, and this is a consistent thing I heard, most people who worked for Theranos have been unable to find work, especially those that were there at the very end. You know, I heard stories about one person who was on job interview, went through up the ladder, and finally got to pretty close to the top, and I guess the CEO or someone up there looked at the resume and said, "Oh, you worked at Theranos. I'm sorry, we can't hire you. That's like that's a bad look for us." Another person who was working at a company who someone, you know, people found out they worked at Theranos and they were asked not to work there anymore. You know, things like that have happened. And there are lots and lots of stories. There was someone who was telling me that one of their colleagues is like back living at home with their parents in a state of depression because their 8 years of degrees are now kind of invalid because Theranos is on their resume. And so I think that people are really pissed off about it. And now, and what else you're seeing is that Elizabeth is on social media. She's now engaged. She has she met a guy who's 10 years younger than her. She's engaged to, and she's on social media having like the time of her life and posting pictures and going to horse races and, you know, living this life as if nothing ever happened.
Is she still out in the Valley? Is she,
The one time that Elizabeth ever lost her cool, at least as far as I'm aware, was, and I really lost it, was, part of the deal that they had made with Fortress, my understanding is that Fortress, there was some language in the deal that if there was ever criminal charges or something like that, that Elizabeth would have to step down as CEO or chairman or whatever it was. And when the criminal charges were filed, she was forced to do that. There were 11 criminal counts charged against her. The CFO or the financial folks at Theranos were like, look, we can't continue to pay for your lifestyle anymore. We can't continue to pay for your 10,000 square foot Los Altos house and the cars and the drivers and this, that, and the other. And apparently, according to folks that were there, she lost her shit was like an irate teenager screaming and yelling at this.
But that's interesting. So your story ends you know, at least chronologically, to some extent, with, you know, the end of Theranos. So but Elizabeth Holmes gets Balto in September 2017. By September 2018, Theranos is done. It's shuttered. That $900 million is up in smoke. But what's so fascinating to me is that you're reporting that after Theranos, one could put, she had her eye on a new kind of redemption story. Tell us what's going on now with her.
Well, the first thing that happens is towards the end, as this is all really, really coming apart and, you know, everyone's leaving and it's clear that this thing's done and it's they've got all these law firms. Elizabeth, I don't know what the hell's going through her head, but she decides that she's going to take Balto the wolf, because we got to come back to Balto here, and she is going to enroll him in a search and rescue program so that in case there's ever a big massive earthquake in California, she will be able to go with Balto and rescue people from the rubble. There's two problems here. One is she doesn't know what the hell she's talking about. Balto is a Siberian husky, and huskies are not dogs that are used in search and rescue. There's a reason you don't see them in the rubble when buildings collapse, because they are runners. They run from Anchorage, Alaska to places 600 miles away with serums that cure diphtheria. They, you know, these are running dogs that will run and chase things. And so they go every weekend. Elizabeth goes with Balto to this search and rescue place, and Balto is chasing squirrels and other dogs, and eventually, of course, fails out of this. Eventually, what happens is, you know, she gets these criminal charges. The company shuts its doors. She has to leave Los Altos and her big house, and she goes up to San Francisco, and she now lives in a relatively small condo. She's engaged to this guy who works in the driverless car industry, and she believes that she was the one who was slighted, and she is the victim in this whole story. She thinks that this all is the fault of John Carreyrou. She thinks that it's her lawyer's fault for not stopping John. She truly believes that she could have gone to the Journal when these first stories came out and used her magic witch powers to convince John, a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter, to have not done these stories, which I think is just kind of unbelievably ludicrous that she even believes that. And she blames her lawyers and the team around her for not giving her the right or not making the right decisions. Meanwhile, the thing that I've always heard from the beginning of when I first started reporting about her and the company years ago is that there was not a single decision that went through the company that did not go through her. Hiring took months sometimes because she had to be the one to finally approve the hiring of people even in low-down positions. So she's now living with Balto in San Francisco, and she goes out a lot to cafes and restaurants. She tells people that people always come up to her and tell her how much they admire her and that they're rooting for her. Which I don't know if that's true or not. It's Silicon Valley, so it could very well be true. But that's where things stand right now.
And she wants to get her side of the story out there too, right?
Yep.
She wants to. Yep. She thinks that she's been victimized here, and that there's another act left in her.
She believes. Well, first of all, I've heard from one source that she's trying to start a new company. I've heard from other sources
that. In what space? What kind of?
I don't know. All I know is that there were people that confirmed that she had met with VCs about a new company. There are VCs out there who will remain nameless because they are litigious people that that I know she's met with that would probably fund her.
That's crazy. That's crazy.
Yeah, which is insane. Totally insane. She
nuts.
Is also she wants to write her own book that will compete with John Carreyrou's, that will be called Good Blood or something. I don't know. That will tell her side of the story. She has tried. She's been meeting with documentary filmmakers. She wants to tell her own side of the story through a documentary. I mean, God knows where this is going to go. I think that the thing that is really kind of crazy is that she has 11 criminal counts against her. She could go to jail for 20 years. She could go to jail for more than 20 years. The district attorney who's handling the case, the DOJ, said in a recent statement they're going through 17 million words of documents, all from the early days of Theranos onwards, and that the case seems to be much larger and go much deeper than they originally thought it did when they first brought those 11 counts. And the other thing I've heard is that from a very reliable source on this one is that the DOJ and the FBI are using all of this reporting from CarrieU, from MarketWatch, from TechCrunch, Forbes, all of the things that when Elizabeth Holmes went out there and she originally was doing these stories and these interviews talking about how she could do 1,000 tests from one blood prick. She could, you know, all these things that she was saying that were BS. Those are the things that will probably come back to haunt her because that's her words. That's the company's words. And they're completely different from what reality really was.
Nick, I'll get you out here on this, and then you can have your podcast back next week. But why do you think this case has so fascinated people? You know, it's occasionally we find a sort of so-called business world villain who just, you know, consumes the popular culture. Bernie Madoff was one, but of course he was because the vast criminality of his enterprise was galling. Mark Dreyer, another, I suppose, Michael Milken in the 80s, though he certainly redeemed himself. My God, what a second act. But it's really, really rare. Why do you think Elizabeth Holmes' story has so fascinated people? And does it look differently in a world where, like, you know, Theranos made gigantic mistakes before the Russians hacked Facebook to deliver an election to Donald Trump? Do her misdeeds seem different now that we know how truly bad Silicon Valley can be?
I think the difference with the thing with the Elizabeth Holmes story is the thing that we wish would happen with everything. You know, it's this, we live in a world where once again, you know, this has happened for hundreds and hundreds of years where the rich, powerful people get away with the things they get away with. You know, it was kings and queens, then it was hedge fund guys, and it was the media, and now it's Silicon Valley, and I'm sure there's a million things in between there. Where people
Me Too
that,
is part of that too, by the way. I think that's part
of
the...
Yeah, Me Too is part of that. Yeah, Black Lives Matter is part of that.
Yeah.
We live in a world where people have gotten away with things for so long that we all knew was unjust. And you see that happening in Silicon Valley. You see Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg suffering zero reprisals for all the things they did that led to the fake news and the rise of Trump. You know, I have a guest on the podcast next week, Roger McNamee, who has a book out called Zucked, who is going to talk about that very thing, about how he warned Facebook before the even election happened that there was fake news happening, and Sheryl and Mark just kind of brushed it off as not a big deal. They tried to water down the reports from employees that said that these things were happening. You see it with Jack Dorsey. You see it with Elon Musk. You see time and time and time again Peter Thiel, you know, getting away with what he gets away with, running a company Palantir that literally takes our data and uses it against us. And there's nothing we can do about it. And what happens with the Elizabeth Holmes story is that finally someone who did something really bad, who did a blood testing product that was truly harming patients, could have killed people, that they suffered the consequences of that. And I think that's why everyone wants to read this story. We want to feel like the bad guy or the bad woman or whatever it is that they end up suffering the consequences. And I think that's why this is such a fascinating story. I think the thing that's so interesting is that, you know, and this is in my piece, is that, you know, all the people who run these companies, they have the same kind of mentality. They have this, you know, Mark Zuckerberg looks at the 2.4 billion people on Facebook and says, well, where are the other 3.7 billion on Earth that should be on this platform? You know, these are people who they have kind of psychological problems where nothing is ever enough. Being the richest man on earth, a Jeff Bezos, is not enough. He still treats every single day like it's the first day of work for his company, for Amazon. And I think that, you know, we all can't do much to stop this from all happening. And then here's an instance where we did.
Well, on that bright and chipper note, Nick, I'll let you out of your own podcast.
There's one other thing that I think that we forgot to mention, which I think is actually pretty funny, is there's a part in the story where I kind of talk about all the crazy shit about all these CEOs. The thing that I find so fascinating is that all these CEOs in Silicon Valley have these very bizarre quirks. And they have them because they want to be separated, even though they're like of the top echelon of humanity and the most powerful people on earth. It's still not enough for them. And so, like, Steve Jobs used to wear his black turtleneck and park in handicapped spots and was a fruitarian. Mark Zuckerberg had this phase where he used to kill his own animals that he would eat and taser them and then shoot them with some weird gun. What's his name? Thiel, who allegedly talked about drinking the blood of young people to be able to live longer. The CEO of Nintendo, who walks around with a tape measure.
Right, yeah.
So he can measure, he guesses the size of like a table or a chair and then measures it to see if he's right. And if he's wrong, he's very upset with himself. And then you've got Holmes, who kind of encapsulates all of these weird quirks. She's like, she wanted so badly to be famous, to stand out, to do all these things that, you know, she starts wearing the black turtleneck. She only drinks weird green juices. She, you know, she goes through all these bizarre things and eventually gets a dog called Balto that she tells everyone is a wolf.
So, we'll see where it goes. Nick Bilton, thanks for appearing on Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. It was a real pleasure to have you. You're fired. I'm hijacking this show.
Thanks for being the host of the podcast, John Kelly. And be sure to check out the story on Vanity Fair's Hive. Thanks to my guest today. That's me, Nick Bilton, and of course, John Kelly for being the host. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. There are lots and lots to listen to in the archives. You can find these, of course, on Apple Podcasts, radio.com, or anywhere you get your podcasts. Don't forget to leave a review while you're there. Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work, and thanks, of course, to my sponsors this week, Groa and Policy Genius. Please support them the same way you support this podcast. I will see you all next week for another exciting episode of Inside the Hive.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
From PRX.